You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance and this is Studio Visit. Now, in the past year, two seismic shocks have altered the social, cultural and political climate in Turkey. The failed military coup of July 2016 and the referendum for constitutional reform in April of this year. Both events have led to stricter controls on civic life and increased powers for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, or AKP. Reports of censorship are coming thick and fast, and this is why Studio Visit has chosen to focus on current arts, culture, and sociological study emerging from or about Turkish society. As a contribution to the exhibition Letter from Istanbul, a group show opening on the 15th of June at Pi Artworks in London, both this month and next month's programmes will be dedicated to exploring the work of Turkish sociologists and cultural theorists. My first guest this week is Shalan Shunler, author of a groundbreaking study of Turkish daytime talk shows, which gave a platform to urban and rural working class women, usually denied a voice in the media. The book, titled Women and Cultural Citizenship in Turkey, Mass Media and Women's Voice Television, offers an incisive overview of shows that opened a door to the oppressive world of gender honor codes, that gave a voice and media presence to those oppressed by them, and a series of shows that ultimately fell short of empowering its audience. I began our interview by asking, what were the important formal distinctions between women's voice talk shows and their British or US counterparts, between, say, Ricky Lake and Yasmin Bozkurt's Women's Voice?
The first thing to know is your voice, or the woman's voice genre in general, is very long. It's about 3 hours long, including commercials, so about 2 hours without commercials, which actually created, and they're done every day of the week, and they're aired live, which when I visited the studios, I was shocked to notice that there was very, very little editing, very little coaching of the guests, no scripts. I mean, I observed one guest that appeared that was being kind of interviewed in the background as I was having my interview with one of the you know, executive producer. And he was subsequently on air, you know, about 2 hours later. And, you know, I didn't notice anything that the producers were saying to him. Hey, say this, say that, or any sort of coaching like that, or even, you know, editing of the show because they were aired live. So while something like Ricky Lake or, you know, Oprah was carefully edited, you know, scholars that studied those shows found, such as Joshua Gamson, for example, they found that these shows were, you know, very much scripted, very much rehearsed, some of them. The women's voice programs were actually much less so. I mean, I'm not going to say that they don't go through some sort of filter, you know, that the mass media presents, but they were very little. There was very little editing, coaching, scripting, things like that.
What are some of the typical stories that might appear on a program?
They're usually framed as missing person cases, which is, you know, very common in this kind of like daytime talk show genre. But then it turns out, as you start watching the show, that these are not really missing person cases. It can be that a woman's children have been taken away from her, for example, and she hasn't seen her children in some cases 20 years, you know, some cases a couple months. So basically what she's doing is going on television and telling and basically pleading for the return of her child. The child turns out to be sometimes, typically, in my sample I found, is being held by either this woman's ex-husband and his family, or her late husband's family, Because of some of the ways the gender honor code works, the family decided that the children were not to be left under this woman's custody. So, that was a very fascinating case for me because seeing these over and over again, I found 8 of those cases in out of 90. So, something like 10% of the cases were women looking for their children who were taken away from them and not necessarily missing. But initially, it's presented as a missing person case. Sometimes it's a woman who's missing, and it turns out that maybe she was being beaten at home. She was actually being seriously physically abused, and she runs away from home, and the family's on television pleading for her return or trying to understand where she went.
But then some of the other stories might be somebody seeking divorce or a separation, or sometimes maybe domestic abuse might come into it, and also custody.
Yes, so the custody questions come up typically in that first kind of case that I was mentioning, where women lose custody of their children, or maybe legally they have custody of their children, but the children are literally hidden from them. They're taken by the ex-husband's or late husband's family, and they're nowhere to be found. They actually, change addresses. They move houses. They, take the kids from the school that they were going to and send them to a different school. In some cases, they don't send them to school at all, just so the mother can't find the child or the children. So those were, yes, those were pretty common. And then in the process, stories of physical abuse, sexual abuse, other kinds of abuse are raised. Even rape is a topic that comes up, interestingly and surprisingly.
So this is where the sort of radical, if you can say that, radical component of the Women's Voice programs comes into being, because these are all discourses and discussions that are kind of absent from the media, it seems to me, or at least this particular demographic that's on the Women's Voice talk shows are absent from the media discussing these sorts of topics.
Absolutely. This concept of cultural citizenship is precisely about that. Because I noticed especially prior to 1990s, which is when Turkey got its first commercial television channels, it's a very kind of almost sterile, very well scripted and very well edited version of Turkish society that we see on mass media. And mass media prior to 1990 basically means TRT, which is a Turkish radio television broadcasting government broadcasting agency, essentially. After 1990, and especially with the Women's Voice programs, we start seeing quote unquote real people talking about their own issues in their own voices. So cultural citizenship is all about who gets to be heard, who gets to tell their stories, who gets to speak in their own voice rather than being maybe spoken about or spoken to. That it's a very new and very, in my opinion, raw and real kind of view of society, and that's why they received such strong kind of reactions from those who didn't like this, who were what I call the Republicans or the established or urban dwellers.
So I'm glad you mentioned Republican capital because, or Republicans, because I think it would be good for us to go into this idea now as well. So maybe previous to the entrance of commercial television programs taking over from, say, TRT or competing with TRT, you could say maybe cultural citizenship was just the purview of people with high Republican capital.
Exactly.
So, could you describe what this concept of Republican capital is in the Turkish context?
It's always uneasy to invent these concepts and attach them to groups of people, and it's not always neat. So I always, even when I use the established urban dwellers, squatter town residents, and also those with Republican capital, those with low Republican capital, it's always, there's always some overlaps, and it's not perfectly neat. As a sociologist, I would be, remiss if I acted like, these are very clear-cut definitions and distinctions. But what I mean by Republican capital is, people who I consider with high Republican capital, they tend to be urban, secular, they display modern kind of dispositions, quote unquote modern, which in the Turkish case means Western. So, for example, a Republican woman would not wear an Islamic hijab and would probably be also critical of those who do. They're also Kemalists in the sense that they are believers and followers of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was, the founder of the Republic. And they believe that Atatürk's Republican Revolution created an ideal society. It has liberated women, they believe, and gave everyone in the nation an equal chance to succeed. So they believe that the Turkish society that was created by Atatürk and his followers, the founding fathers, was one that was kind of beyond racism, beyond sexism, beyond classism. So they're somewhat blind to the reality that some women were left behind by the Republican Revolution. Some ethnic groups were left behind, and obviously there's class distinctions in the country. So these are some of the kind of, I think, distinguishing factors that apply to Republicans.
You mentioned the other great distinction in the book there, which is between established urban dwellers and squatter town residents. This is another sort of a conceptual tool that you introduce in the book, but it made it easier to think through how you were sort of schematizing society. I should also make clear that you don't say that these are totally kind of distinct and mutually exclusive groups, that there is a lot of crossover.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But nevertheless, could you describe maybe a basic issue that served to divide these two communities socially and culturally?
Sure. Established urban dwellers, as their name would suggest, they reside in established neighborhoods of Istanbul, typically, and they generally have access to the formal employment sectors. The squatter town residents, we can say, are living in the outskirts of the city. And as again, their name would suggest, them or their parents built some sort of squatter town residence in, on some land. And eventually, through some political due to some political leaders' kind of quest for votes, those houses became their legal homes. So they live in those homes, they own their homes at this time point in time. But they also are kind of excluded from the formal employment sector. Sometimes there's problems with access to education. Or established urban dwellers are people who are probably a little more educated, highly educated. They have, again, access to formal employment sectors. Maybe they're civil servants. They can be police officers or teachers or people like that. Some of them work in the, multinational corporations that have been, popping up in the country since the 1990s or so. It's a class distinction, I would say. And the established urban dwellers are also more likely to have high Republican capital. But I've also met squatter town residents who had Republican capital in the sense that they had a firm belief in the Republican Revolution and were Kemalists, but they still lacked maybe some of those class privileges that established urban dwellers had, such as access to formal employment or a university education.
But to get a sense of the sort of overarching frame that sort of women find themselves within Turkish society, would you say that what you identified in the book as the kind of tripartite normative gender roles of women apply to both distinctions? So you schematized it as women are either categorized as sort of gracious ladies, housewives, or mothers. Mm-hmm. Does that sort of stereotypical view work across the board when it's being employed, basically?
Yes, I would say so. I think the concept of the gender honor code really applies to both groups of women, all groups of women, but the established urban dwellers or those with high Republican capital are less likely to recognize or acknowledge how much they're under the same gender honor code as the women that they sometimes scorn as not being as emancipated as they are, i.e. the squatter town residents or those with low Republican capital. So you know, one of the revelations, I think, of the literature that came out in the 1990s and after the 1990s in Turkey, in the, you know, social science fields, is to make it clear to us that, yes, the Republican Revolution has emancipated women and has given women rights. And in some cases, you know, women do better than some other, you know, European countries, some cases. But it's a major class distinction, and it's a some women were really left behind, and those women tend to be the rural women and the rural urban women, so the squatter town residents or the women whose families never migrated to the cities. So their circumstances are very much under the gender honor code.
So I'd like to talk a bit about the shows now. And what was interesting to me about reading about the Women's Voice talk shows was that it seemed to be quite informal and almost a bit precarious for the talk show hosts.
Yes.
Like they were moving in and out of programs quite quickly. Could you talk a bit about maybe just that overall scene?
Yes. It was very haphazard. very informal. One of the hosts shared with me that she was a newscaster for the network that she was working for, TGRT, and they came to her with an offer because the former host of the Woman's Voice show that, you know, that was on air at the same channel had moved on to a different network. So they made an offer to her, and literally Monday she was hosting Woman's Voice. Which, you know, the consequences of that, of course, is she was utterly unprepared for what she was getting into. You know, the stories that she was going to have to deal with and you know, direct, and the kinds of issues that are raised on the programs are incredibly, of course, difficult and sometimes difficult to hear. And the interviews that I observed at the set visits were with the potential guests. Indicated to me that, you know, pretty much anyone who shows up and has a story to tell is, you know, admitted onto the show. So, which again creates this very interesting public sphere where women and men talked about issues in their own lives, in their own voices, with little scripting, editing, coaching, etc.
So you managed to spend a bit of time attending the filming of these programs. What were some of the dynamics that played out between the guests and the hosts?
Sure. So it depends on the host. I think two of the hosts, Ezgü and Bozkurt, they were already celebrities when they started doing these shows. So the air that they had was very much that of a celebrity. I don't think Ezgü even stuck around and interacted with the host during commercial breaks. You know, we were still sitting in the studio, of course, and I think she would disappear and then she would come back when...
Oh, really?
Yes, when the airing started. In one, you know, disturbing scene, I actually observed her making fun of one of her guests behind her back. She was making fun of her physical attributes, and she made the audience members laugh by imitating this poor woman and her some of her physical attributes, which weren't, you know, perhaps very attractive or something. But I didn't have a chance to interview her, so I'm not sure how she felt about her guests. But I'm gonna guess that she, you know, had an air of superiority, and she definitely didn't see them as at the same level as her. I even noticed that she would usually address her guests as in the informal you, which we have in Turkish, you know, like the Spanish and French, you know, we have the informal you and the formal you. And she, depending on what her guests looked like and what they acted like and what the story was, she would sometimes refer to or address some of the women with the formal you, but typically it was the informal. So, you know.
But then I remember you saying that some of the hosts were a bit more sensitive to their guests, or they had a different role that they took on in relation to their guests. Is it Inci Ertuğrul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Ertuğrul was, her own social background was, I believe her father was a public school teacher. So she had traveled the countryside of Turkey, and she had lived in the countryside of Turkey. So I think as a, you know, just her personal experiences, you know, opened her up to more appreciation of, you know, the gender honor code and understanding of it. And also maybe, you know, she didn't have that air of superiority because of that, because she was also from a, you know, from a more modest, more humble background. She was also humble enough to ask me for recommendations, for example, for books, so that she could understand the circumstances of the women better that she was interviewing, you know, every day. And I think she definitely meant well. But some of the structural limitations of the shows, I think, kept her from, you know, doing any sort of, I think, public good. Let's call it that.
You make a really nice distinction between phenomenological and objective perspectives, mm-hmm. or ways of viewing behavior in the book. And it's something that I'm definitely going to take forward in looking at different things.
Oh, great.
Basically, the phenomenological perspective just looks at the behavior as it happens, mm-hmm. without trying to look at it in reference to wider structural contexts or social or political context. But then the objective perspective takes those into account. But what you were saying in the book was that maybe the hosts relied too much on the phenomenological perspective. Mm-hmm. And but what did this stop the Women's Voice hosts from being able to do?
I think it kept them from seeing the structure and making the structure visible to their viewers. That's a potential that they could have tapped into. And I had this question for every single you know, producer, executive, and host that I had a chance to interview. And I also spoke about this with the, you know, the feminists and the feminist groups that I had a chance to interview. And there was this sort of miscommunication, or this like mutual scorn, or some sort of miscommunication between the feminist organizations or other women's rights organizations and the hosts, as well as the producers and the executives of the shows. So the shows really reveal the gender honor code, and it's and outlines it. You know, a woman, for example, a woman who divorces or if her husband dies, she has to go back to her father's house and remain there until, if she's young, she definitely has to remarry, for example. But then the gender honor code dictates that if she is to remarry, it's possible that her children may be taken away from her, if they haven't been taken away from her in the first place, because that means the children will be raised under the patri line of a different man, which, according to the gender honor code, is unacceptable. For example, this is a very clear structure that emerges from the shows. It's you know, these are the rules. Of course, the rules are always, can be bent. The rules are always, you know, different, can be different by context, but these are the rules. And what the hosts don't do, and I don't know if it's by choice or if, you know, I don't know why they don't do it exactly, but they don't go there. So they treat every single case as if it's this individual's fault or their problem. And then in turn, they also suggest individual solutions. So they could have gone to the place of, oh, you know, this is a structural problem. This is a big problem that many women in this country face. You know, let's see how we can help them. Let's maybe provide phone numbers to agencies, or, you know, give them the district attorney's phone number, who can maybe direct them in the case of, you know, a child not being shown to them, you know, or even allowed to visit with them. But things like that are not done. And I mean, of course, I have theories, and some of my interviews revealed some of the reasons why these are not done, but I'm still not sure why exactly this disconnect happened between and the, I mean, I'm guessing they just don't care. You know, all they really care about is their bottom line. And the shows were very lucrative. They were, you know, cheap to produce, and they had good ratings. So, you know, they were very lucrative for the network. So they didn't want to, they didn't care, essentially, to make a difference.
This distinction between the phenomenological and objective perspective is something that I see in, let's say, maybe socially conscious programming that happens with the British Broadcasting Corporation. Mm-hmm. So they have a tendency to show programs about homelessness or drug addiction, but they don't show how the society, the structure of society itself, contributes to those problems. Like, they're not just individual emotional failings.
Exactly.
And they don't link that to organizations that might be able to help. Mm-hmm. They don't inform, I guess, the victim who is in that situation, but they also don't inform the viewer. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that this was something that was being replicated again in the Women's Voice programs, almost as a kind of strategy for programmers to tackle socially and politically pertinent issues, but without actually fully committing.
Exactly. I mean, when I asked the question, for example, one of the executives, I asked her, why wouldn't you, for example, have a little section at the end where, you know, it can be, you know, a little subtitle or something where it says, this is how you contact your district attorney's office, or this is how you contact an agency. And it could be just, you know, one number, right? And she said, oh, you know, we're a national network, you know, which district attorney's office number should we provide? You know, there are so many. When, you know, I mean, the majority of Turkish population lives in Istanbul, you know, that's a start, right? Or maybe do a different city every day, and you'll get to all the cities eventually, right? Anything. So it was just complete disinterest. Bozkurt, one of the posts, dismissed the women's movement as just a bunch of women who get together and drink tea or something like that. She was completely dismissive of their accomplishments. So I'm not exactly sure why that disconnect happened, but it was definitely there. Theory is they didn't care. And, you know, I find a little bit of blame in the feminists, too. Maybe they didn't try hard enough to reach out and build those bridges either.
But there are also instances in which a kind of societal critique enters into the programme. Almost it's hard to stop it because of the 3-hour nature, because it's so informal and it's live.
Sure. Even when that happened, there are couple monologues where, you know, I think Ertuğrul is one of them, where, you know, she goes into the fact that, you know, there's a double standard when a woman cheats versus if a man cheats. You know, the audience, for example, is very likely to forgive the man for cheating and maybe ask his wife to forgive him. Whereas if a woman cheats, you know, that's considered completely dishonorable. She just doesn't even have the right to see her children anymore, according to the audience. So when something like that emerged, Ertuğrul would actually kind of embark on this whole thing, you know, monologue where she would talk about how that's a double standard. But then again, you know, it almost immediately turned back to, but it's really her problem. But it's really, you know, this individual's choice or whatever it is. So that, again, I mean, you know, and one of the things that Bourdieu says, for example, is it's a mistake to think of our respondents, interviewees, you know, or the, you know, regular people in the world as sociologists. So maybe that structure was, you know, somehow not clear to them, or they didn't have the background, the capacity to kind of understand the structure or analyze it. So one of the feminist activists that I interviewed suggested, well, you know, when you go to a media and communications program at any university, you don't have to take a gender studies course. You know, and maybe that's what's missing. Maybe that sort of like gender equality consciousness, feminist consciousness was missing. So it may be also a general, again, structural deficiency in the system that didn't allow these women to recognize what was right in front of them.
You conducted this study back in 2005, mm-hmm. and a lot has changed, obviously, since then. I'm wondering, like, how have the Women's Voice programs evolved, or have they kind of disappeared and morphed into something else?
Mm-hmm. They have disappeared. And I can't remember now exactly what year the last one was, off air, was canceled. And they essentially became a liability for the networks. Some of the women who appeared on the shows, unfortunately, were killed, were victims of honor killing. So the programs kind of evolved into matchmaking programs. So what they are now, and even that has been banned recently, is matchmaking programs.
That was sociologist Sherlan Şanlı talking about the brief history of women's voice talk shows in Turkey. Now, one of the more nefarious results of Malcolm Gladwell's book of socio-economic evangelism, The Tipping Point, was an entirely positive and uncritical portrayal of Rudy Giuliani's broken windows policy, a branch of his zero-tolerance approach to policing that saw petty crimes like broken windows as gateways to more serious offences like murder, robbery and drug addiction. Despite it being discounted by various studies, the broken windows approach has been adopted and used in various urban settings across the world and is now part of the portfolio of strategies employed to discipline populations and police cities in the grip of neoliberal transformation. As public space is privatised, neighbourhoods are gentrified, affordable housing is replaced by expensive stock, and formal employment is replaced by precarious service sector work, professionalised police forces seem to be following a similar pattern. In the aftermath of a moral panic, populations of usually low-income urban dwellers are profiled as criminal factions who are a threat to public order and are subsequently dealt with as populations whose presence in the city is no longer wanted. My next guest this week is sociologist Zeynep Gurnan, whose new book, The Politics of Crime in Turkey, Neoliberalism, Police and the Urban Poor, is a brilliant study of this process taking place in the Turkish city of Izmir. The book has both a national and international focus, and its publication should have some significant implications for the study of policing in developed urban metropolises worldwide. In other words, this should be essential reading for anyone looking to understand population management and policing in the 21st century. One of the first things you state in the book is that the book isn't a criminological study and that it instead focuses on the politics of crime. So what is the crucial difference between these two approaches for you?
Crime is traditionally studied by discipline of criminology, so it is a topic of criminology. And there is, of course, various approaches within criminology, but what I mean by criminological approach is the one that takes crime and accepts the definition of crime as it is, and develops its analysis over this legal category. Its main questions are generally like why crime occurs, who the criminal is, and how it can be prevented. So these are the kind of questions criminology is interested. But what I find interesting and what I think is that crime has more information in it than just a legal category. Crime is not just a legal category. And criminology oversees this fact and instead, you know, ask these kind of questions that I, as I mentioned. But there is a tradition, a critical tradition that criticizes criminological approach and actually a criminology against criminology that said that crime is actually more than this. Crime is a sociopolitical category, first of all. It entails social, political, historical contexts in which it occurs, and it reflects these dimensions. And in that sense, there is it is not just a legal thing, and it is these dynamics are important to look at in order to understand why crime is occurring. And with politics of crime, we can see this. I mean, with the politics of crime, we can see how crime is being defined by different societies in different historical times. And with politics of crime, we can understand the forces and dynamics that are observable in an act of crime. And we can also see how and why do societies choose to deal with crime, and what are the effects of those choices. That's why I wanted to concentrate and take an approach that looks at crime as a political issue rather than crime as a legal issue.
So what compelled you to tackle the politics of crime by looking at the evolution of policing and criminalization in Izmir? Was it because you were witnessing these changes as a citizen yourself?
The thing is, when I was when I constructed this work, I was studying and working in the US. And I was going back and forth in Turkey, and I wanted to make a research on Turkey. But actually, it is this comparative place that I was having in my life that led me to find this topic. In the US, you know, the issue of criminalization and policing and punishment is a really huge issue, and it is being investigated and examined, and it is also a very socially raised issue with the police violence and the expansion of prisons and prison populations in the US. So observing that, reading about that in the US, and looking back to Turkey and going back and forth in Turkey and following the Turkish events, I also started to realize that there was something going on. I wasn't experiencing them on my own as a citizen, but I was seeing both in the media and whenever I go back to Turkey that there was some kind of, you know, similarities that could be observed. So that's actually what helped me to develop this project. And then when I went back to Turkey for the research, I was again not so aware of the actual things that were going on. And with the research, it became more and more apparent that this was really similar to what was going on in the US. Of course, with a similar, different proportion, but the dynamics and the way in which it was taking place was quite parallel. So this was the comparative position, I have to say, was really the source of my project.
And I think that's a really powerful feature of the book, the way you talk about the politics of crime in Izmir, but then also you realize that actually this is a worldwide phenomenon that is maybe being articulated in different ways by different police forces, but essentially they're kind of, they're singing the same song.
Yes, it is the case. It is very comparable, and it's very this is a parallel process in many different places. As I explain in the book, within all neoliberal context where welfare state is declining, the work conditions are changing, unemployment is rising, and poverty is changing shape. So the responses of the states are to criminalize poverty and manage the populations through policing and penalization. And this is Izmir. The case of Izmir, in that sense, is among other cases in the US, in South Africa, in Britain, in France. So I think this comparison to locate Izmir in that larger context was very important for me. It is not this, you know, specific case. It is not just a little case that is Izmir, but it is also, it explains something about the world in that sense.
So I think it would be a good to get a sense of the Turkish National Police now. So in contrast to the British Metropolitan Police, the TMP are a relatively new force. So I think they began in 1937. They were an organisation that I read in the book that was barred to non-Muslims until 1995, and are currently a force of around 270,000 officers.
And growing.
So, but despite the reforms in 1995, is it still a quite homogenous organization?
Yes. This homogeneity is partly achieved through a recruitment process of the police officers and police personnel. There is some studies about this, but not too many. You have to forgive me with little information about the Turkish National Police, because there is very little research that has been going on the Turkish police. But there is a research on the recruitment process, which suggests that recruitment. With the process, information, all kinds of information for the applicants, not only religion, but also ethnicity, political affiliation, the history of the family and their political affiliation are also researched. And in that recruitment, in that sense, only certain kind of people, and this includes Turkish, right-wing, not left-wing, not Alevis, and not Kurdish populations, who define themselves as Kurdish, they are all, or non-Muslim populations, they are all actually excluded from the police. But there's also the culture of the police organization, which is fostered by the organization's own approach, which creates a homogenized police force. The organization politically always situated itself on the side of the state. It is and against its various internal enemies. And the state's definition of its internal enemies, ranges from the Kurdish opponents to opponents of various kinds. And police also take these people as an enemy, even though they might be citizens and act so. And police organize itself as a homogeneous group in that sense, to be able to fight better with these kind of populations.
It feels to me like there are two key moments that have led to the TMP functioning in its current state. So the 1918 military coup and the process of EU accession that I think began around the later part of the 80s. But let's talk about the post-coup atmosphere first. So how did the police force conduct themselves in the aftermath of that event?
Mm-hmm. I mean, 1980 coup and the military regime that lasted until 1983. Of course, the police has been a subsidiary to military, but afterwards, the police continued to become more and more powerful through adding personnel, weaponry, new units, especially new units against the social movements that the coup was held against. I mean, especially leftist social movements. So it was a clear expansion of the police organization, and it was also a militarized expansion. The police structure and the police units were quite militarized, both in terms of weaponry and in terms of the way it was organized. But on the other hand, I have to also add to, in addition to EU and coup, I have to also add another important element in the shaping of the Turkish National Police after 1980s. It's the war on the PKK, the war on the Kurdish region, that really affected the and empowered the Turkish police. It empowered it through the anti-terror law, through the new units again organized against the Kurdish groups. So there is one more element in the changing of the Turkish National Police in general.
Within those three changes that we were just talking about, though, there is this sense that civil liberties are eroded in the name of national security.
National security, in the name of national security, in the name of law and order, in the name of terror, fighting against terror, yes. Definitely. But on the third one, the EU one, is a different kind of effect, has a different kind of effect.
This seems to me like it's more of a kind of professionalization of the police force.
Yes, with the European Union, the professionalization, modernization, but also there was also demands of democratization of the police force, along with other state institutions. But police force and its democratization, its actions were quite... tried to be changed because it was one of the central organizations of the state violence after the 1980 coup. The regime, I have to note, after 1980 coup, until today, is called September 12th regime in Turkey. It means less democratic institutions, more anti-authoritarian forms of rule. That was shaped by the coup and its aftermath is still intact. And police force was among these, among one of the important institutions that were part of this anti-democratic authoritarian rule.
I think it's important now to maybe talk about the creation of a kind of criminal profile, which you handle really well in the book. So you talk about, you describe the emergence of a moral panic over crime emerged after an incident in 1998. And this moral panic emerged over something that was called capcatch. So mm-hmm. Could you tell me what capcatch was used to describe?
Yeah, in mid-1990s and towards the end of 1990s especially, this talk about capcatch, which is actually a form of mugging. It is mugging, but this new word capcatch started to be used for it. It was on the media every day talking about capcatch events, like a person running and taking your purse, either running away or from a car or from a motorbike, taking your purse and running away. This was what a particular capcatch event could look like. So this event has started to occur a lot in the big cities, or it's were happening a lot, but now this time it was taking the attention of the media. And the media took this event, and it was rather than a third page news, it became a really headline event constantly and every day. Commentaries and news stories and talk about Kapkaç started to expand. And it created a fear about Kapkaç on the one hand, and also other forms of economic crimes that were taking place, maybe more than before in the cities. So this is how the Kapkaç, a panic about Kapkaç started to be created in the late 1990s and 2000s. It became more and more clear.
So you write about how the emergence of Kapkaç also coincided with a generally perceived crisis in policing. But what struck me was that your account of how the police then turned that to their advantage. Could you just describe how they managed to do that?
Yeah, the moral panic about Kapkaç that was developing in the media and was supported by the politicians and police, then really coincided with this police crisis. Police crisis meaning that there was a legitimacy crisis that was going on with the police. There was people did not trust police. There was this corruption going on. People didn't go to the police for the criminal cases. And they also, there was also this long history of police violence and torture that had become very public, both due to EU process, and also human rights organizations' efforts. So police was really untrusted and legitimacy was really, really deteriorated at the time of the moral panic about Kapkaç and crime was taking place. So the rise of crime, according to this crime discourses, was also partially the result of police's inability to do anything, or police's corruption. So it was also a blame to the police that the crime was rising. So the police it was really clever at the time. The police first of all was one of the, they were blamed, but at the same time, they actually took that blame. They said that, yes, we are not being able to do anything because we are powerless. So they took that blame and they took that crisis and tried to turn into an opportunity by saying that they needed more powers, both legally and both in terms of resources, weaponry, personnel. And so that's how actually they, Izmir police also gathered that, wanted to turn that crime discourses into their own advantage. And when the new police office chief to Izmir, he said that he would erase crime from the city, and he understood that he could actually gain legitimacy by fighting crime.
Are you talking about Hüseyin Çapkın?
Yes, Hüseyin Çapkın, when he came to the city in 2006, he started a restructuring process of the Izmir Public Order Police, and he said that he was going to fight with crime. What I'm trying to say is, with the police, the Turkish National Police in general, but Izmir Police also, what they tried to do was to gain power and legitimacy through a fight with crime, which had become such a growing concern with the moral panic about crime and Kapkaç in general. Kapkaç. So the police's professionalization and restructuring in the case of Izmir was really a response to the growing panic as well as the police legitimacy crisis.
One of the problems with accounts of surplus populations in neoliberal cities is that they rarely talk about how surplus populations came to be surplus populations. Mm-hmm. But the great thing about your book is that the final chapter does this really, really well. And it explains how a community came to be profiled, jobless, no longer useful, and therefore criminalised. So I wondered if we could talk a bit about this in relation to Naledere. So this used to be a predominantly working class migrant area, but what has it sort of being changed into now?
I mean, the kind of jobs that they can get is no more there. They were working both in the industrial workshops and as well as the orchards that were around the area, which are now being turned into luxury residences and high rises. So in that sense, the areas of work that they were so easily found are no more there. And most of the time, the youth especially is affected by this. The youth are mostly can find jobs in the construction sector, either construction sector or in the low-end service sector jobs. So these jobs are very, very precarious. And mostly there's also a high rate of unemployment in the area. So in the area in that sense has been a safe, safe working class area. And now the unemployment and in precarious work only affecting especially the young people is also creating a very insecure situation for the area.
And this seemed to me to be one of those crucial points that is being reproduced all over the world. So that one, a population that lives pretty, pretty easily in a particular area suddenly becomes a problem when a new community moves into the area who may have a conception of public order that wasn't there before. So people just being on the streets becomes a problem. And then the sorts of jobs that are available disappear. And then it becomes service sector work, which is precarious.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that that was one of the situations that was happening in these areas that you were talking about, the Tepe, for Tepe residents.
Mm-hmm. Tepe, it was a construct. It is a shanty town. It is still a shanty town, which is again is under threat of being urban, going through an urban transformation to turn it into better housing for upper class residents. But the area has been built by migrants coming from different parts of Turkey, east and middle Anatolia. So they were coming from there and they actually constructed their house on their own on the state-owned land illegally. And their illegal land, these illegal places, shanty towns, were then being recognized by the state. So at least they could live in a place for free and they could have their place and then they could work also. There was also a lot of work to do. So this change is quite clear in Tepe now, where there is no more new construction of shanty towns is possible. In addition to that, people can lose their houses because there is the land is becoming more and more valuable in Narlıdere, and it is better to build big housing complexes for the upper classes than to leave it for the poor. And there's also less work, which I think is not just the problem of Izmir, but also in other places in Turkey. Not the same, but a similar kind of process is also taking place in other cities where poor populations are being forced either away from the large metropolitan areas to outside of the city, as well as there are less work, less secure jobs that are available for these populations in the cities.
So the last bit of news I heard following the attempted coup was that over 1,000 police officers have been detained, which made me think that there must be some quite significant structural changes affecting police forces across Turkey. Have you noticed any changes in Izmir since 2016? I mean, how do you think things are developing?
I mean, on the ground, I cannot observe the effects of this yet. Especially in terms of what I have been looking at, the public order policing, I cannot see the difference yet. But the people who have been dismissed or put into jail from the police organizations are being accused of being a part of the Fethullah organization, the organization that is also being accused of being the part of the attempted coup. So these police officers are being accused of being this new terrorist organization, Fethullah organization. There is some kind of truth in this organization has been known to be really really recruiting a lot of people from the Fethullah organization, and it was seen and understood by the government But at that time, government and the Fethullah organization were quite allies. Only recently, this position have changed, and there is a power struggle between Fethullah organization and the Erdogan government. So the police who are linked to the organization are now being pushed away from the organization. This doesn't necessarily change the structure of the police fighting, but what it does is to open new spaces for the AKP government. New spaces, new personnel that is coming from, according to some sources, not from Fethullah, but other nationalistic or other religious organizations. So in terms of the political positions or the people who are being selected, recruited, the new members of the police force, things aren't going to be so different from before. The police force have received a lot of power, have empowered itself a lot through the fight with crime. New laws and new regulations allowed it to be more active and more powerful in terms of its fight against crime. And that's how they actually gained those power. And this power right now, with the state of emergency, with the new political situation, is now being used not to the common criminals as they were to be used according to the previous discourses. Now these powers are now being used against the political opponents who are trying to claim the streets or put their voices in the streets. But the streets are now especially being controlled by the police forces too much. I mean, that's one of the major changes, the policing of the politicals. That is the most central element of the new policing scheme right now. The common crimes is not much of the concern, it looks like, at the point, but rather it is the control of the politicals.
This month's episode of Studio Visit was made in collaboration with the exhibition Letter from Istanbul, a group exhibition of contemporary art opening on the 15th of June, that's next Thursday evening at Pye Artworks in London at 55 East Castle Street, W1W 8EG. Come along between 6:30 and 9 and visit www.pyeartworks.com for more information.